Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Here in this country, of course, local food is the new way of thinking. And down there, they don't have a choice. That's all they have. But for them, local food is shrimp, rice, coconut milk, lobster.
Vicki Bassman spends her career with the Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs interpreting what's unique about a place and its culture. Food is part of what makes Pearl Lagoon, Nicaragua, unique. She comes in to talk about her new cookbook and her adventures in this isolated Latin American community. Inspired by one of those recipes, Chef Daniel Orr makes a beet vinaigrette. Frog legs are also on the menu today. And with the Farm Bill back on Congress's radar, what will become of funding for food stamps? Harvest Public Media looks at how rural families could be affected. We followed two news stories this week. Luann Johnson here with the details.
It's deja vu for the so-called Dairy Cliff. If Congress can't come to an agreement on the Farm Bill before the next recess, permanent law will be enacted, and milk prices could shoot up to $8 per gallon. This scenario is familiar. Last year, lawmakers faced the same dilemma over the impending fiscal cliff. The government passed a last-minute extension of the 2008 Farm Bill to keep from diving over the dairy cliff. Permanent law means the Farm Bill would revert to the 1949 law, which dictates the government purchase dairy at twice the current market rate. This would mean the purchase price for milk would increase $2 to $3 per gallon. The government predicts demand for milk would then fall by about 9%. But milk prices will not immediately go up to $8 come January 1st. Should the Farm Bill not pass, the effects won't be felt for a little while as changes trickle through the system. The House is in session for the first 2 weeks of December, and the Senate is in session from December 9th through the 20th. This means both houses will be together for 5 days to attempt to settle many pending issues, including the Farm Bill. The current extension on the Farm Bill expired on September 30th. Contention over cuts to SNAP and farm subsidies have stalled a bill that commonly has bipartisan support. And fast food workers in 100 U.S. cities planned strikes this week, the largest in a year-long push for higher wages and better working conditions. Organizers are calling the walkouts the biggest single-day action since the movement began. Protests started last year in New York City when a group of about 200 fast food workers walked away from their jobs at 30 restaurants. The move sparked a chain reaction that spread to several major cities. Retail and federal contract employees have since joined the fight, staging strikes in more than 50 cities on August 29th. Groups leading the charge include Fast Food Forward in New York and Fight for 15 in Chicago. Activists are calling for a $15 hourly wage minimum, better working conditions, and the right to unionize without retaliation. David Rojas, communications director for the Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago, said the movement is gaining steam and participants are seeing benefits like promotions, full-time hours, and small raises. While these gains are far below the group's targets, organizers take some credit for state and local minimum wage increases. New Jersey approved a $1 increase to $8.25 last month, and Rhode Island, California, Connecticut, and New York all boosted their minimum wages earlier this year. President Barack Obama said he supports a federal minimum wage hike from $7.25 an hour to $10 an hour. Read more about these stories on our website. Find links in this week's podcast post at eartheats.org.
Our Twitter feed and Facebook page always buzzing with activity. Find out about the latest food news as soon as we do. Get recipes as well. Connect with us at Earth Eats. Luann Johnson reads the news. See you next week.
Thanks, Annie.
As Farm Bill negotiations continue in Washington, it's fairly certain that the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, will be cut. One proposal could trim the food stamp program by $4 billion over the next decade. The other would cut roughly 10 times that much. That's after the Obama administration's recession-era boost to SNAP expired November 1st, leaving the average family with about $30 less to spend each month. But this isn't just an urban concern. Families living amid fertile farmlands struggle to put food on the table and increasingly rely on SNAP benefits. Since the year 2000, the number of rural communities experiencing high poverty has gone up nearly 30%. To understand the hunger issues in rural America, Harvest Public Media's Peter Gray traveled to Marion County in far southern Illinois, which has a higher percentage of food stamp eligibility than the city of Chicago. He files this report.
Sandoval, Illinois is a rural community at a crossroads, literally at Routes 50 and 51. On this clear, cold fall morning, those passing through who aren't in tractors or trucks hauling grain to the local elevator are headed to work outside of town, some commuting 70 miles west to the city of St. Louis. Many of those who stay in town, like 36-year-old Becky Miller, a divorced mother of two girls, work mostly minimum wage jobs. Miller makes $9 per hour at this daycare center along Route 51. To keep her kids fed, she relies on $200 each month in SNAP benefits. In Illinois, that means charging to a link card.
Small town, everybody knows everybody. They're in everybody's business. You know, if I was to go just to a local dollar store and use my link card and someone happened to see me, oh, it would be spread around. Sandoval, you have to be thick-skinned.
Whether they have thick skin or not, one in five households in this area qualifies for the federal food stamp program. And as Congress cuts those benefits, SNAP recipients in rural communities like Sandoval face a harsh reality. Other aid is simply harder to come by than in big cities. Miller sees every month just how real that is.
You usually go to churches, but if you need any kind of help, it's such a struggle around here to get help.
One helper in the area is Kathy Donnelly, who works in the school district. Donnelly's job is to make sure kids get what they need to stay in school. Her office is stacked to the ceiling with backpacks, toothpaste, underwear, socks, kits to remove lice. Around here, truancy officers have to go the extra mile to make sure hungry families get support when food stamps and other programs fall short.
I've been inquiring with kids, you know, what would you like for Christmas? Food.
Donnelly says just because parents get food stamps doesn't mean they can access healthy food.
The only public transportation we have in our area is a transit system that costs a boatload of money to be able to ride. So that's kind of a dead end. So a lot of these people are on foot.
Access to public transit, support programs, and financial education are big problems in many rural communities, says researcher Craig Gunderson at the University of Illinois in Urbana. He tracks hunger and food stamp issues.
There's a lot of rural areas with a great deal of challenges that they face, especially in some very small rural counties. So there's definitely pockets of rural counties with really high unemployment rates, really high poverty rates.
Just east of Sandoval in Odin, Illinois, population 1,000, Pastor Kurt Matthews unloads pallets of bread for storage at his church. He and his wife Kim rely on volunteers who drive hundreds of miles each week to truck in food. This is one of just eight pantries in Marion County. By comparison, the city of St. Louis alone has about 80. This small ministry helps seniors and children alike. They've gone from 50 to 450 families since the mid-90s, and pantry director Kim Matthews says they're bracing for even greater need.
Because of the issues with the food stamps being cut, you know, the 1st of November, I mean, I cannot even tell you how many families said we get nothing now. They cut us totally off. No food stamps.
And with more cuts looming, that rural safety net may be stretched even further. Reporting from Southern Illinois, Peter Gray, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media, harvestpublicmedia.org. Vicky Bassman first traveled to the Pearl Lagoon Basin of Nicaragua 8 years ago to teach sustainable tourism workshops to the people living in that isolated part of the Atlantic coast. She fell in love with the people, the culture, and the food. Her new cookbook highlights all of those aspects of her time in Pearl Lagoon, with the stories paired with photographs and traditional recipes.
Here in this country, of course, local food is the new way of thinking. And down there, they don't have a choice. That's all they have. But for them, local food is shrimp, rice, coconut milk, lobster.
Cheese. First of all, before we get too far, how would we greet each other if we were in the Pearl Lagoon right now?
It's fun to walk down the street and see people, and they'll often rely on you, and I always like to beat them to the greeting. And whereas in the rest of Nicaragua, you would say buenos dias. On the Atlantic coast, you just say hello or good day or how are you? And boy, right away, you get back a big smile, a flash of bright white teeth, and they are very happy to say, you know, how are you today, or good day, or hello. Mm-hmm.
You went there in 2008. It's 2013. Yeah. What happened in these 5 years?
A lot. We went back in October of this year, so just 2 months ago, to deliver the books because they were printed in Managua and they sat in Managua waiting for us to get down there. And then we took several hundred of them. 1,000 have been printed. We took several hundred out to Pearl Lagoon for them to sell. And I was shocked at the changes. The main thing that has happened is that in 2008, the government of Nicaragua has completed a road for the first time in the history of the country, a road out to Pearl Lagoon. So on previous trips, we flew to the community of Bluefields, which is on the Atlantic coast, but it's south of Pearl Lagoon. And then from Bluefields, you had to rent a boat and go up the Atlantic coast to get into the Pearl Lagoon basin, where the community of Pearl Lagoon and the other communities are located. So here you were in this little Caribbean town, and there were no vehicles because there was no road ever to that town.
Wow.
Right? And so it had this very quiet, very laid-back atmosphere. The loudest noise was maybe pigs squealing, chickens clucking, you know, people calling to one another.
I wonder if this means big box grocery stores are not too far away?
I think an impact like that would still be very far away. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I noticed flipping through the book, it's so charming because the recipes and the stories really flow together. It's almost like the food is sort of the main character in the storytelling, and the people come and go and they change, but the food is what we're focusing on.
Absolutely. I think that any interpreter in this country, whether they work at the Park Service or for state parks or county parks, when you think of someone who is interpreting a resource, the good ones are storytellers. And they find the intangibles, the things that make the resource come alive. Whether you're talking about the beauty of the Grand Canyon or a historic home or the beauty of Pearl Lagoon, to me, it's through the use of storytelling. So when I conceived of this book idea, yes, I'd fall in love with the baked goods. And I was trying to find a sustainable tourism product that the people could sell. They really, for the tourists that do get to Pearl Lagoon, there's very little for them to buy and take home to remember their trip. So I thought, let's write these recipes down. And people could take home, both in a written format and photography-wise and story-wise, a memory of their trip. And they could go home and make coconut rice and beans and remember the flavor of the trip. So it all just felt like a package that worked together.
Vicki Bassman will introduce us to some of the flavors of Pearl Lagoon later in the show, recipes for Johnny Cakes and a really simple beet juice. Speaking of beets,
let's go out and pull some beets.
Chef Daniel Orr has a great recipe for beet vinaigrette, and he uses it on just about every dish he makes. It's one of those every sauces. First, grabbing some beets fresh from the garden.
Now, this year we didn't really have great success with our beets, but size doesn't always matter. So we're going to take some of these and we're going to make a beet vinaigrette. So even with just a few little beets, we can make a nice salad dressing or dip. And it's good on all kinds of things. And we even use it at the restaurant as kind of a Jackson Pollock type paint that we paint our plates with. So let's go into the kitchen.
Beets, not the prettiest of all foods.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't like beets because they say they taste like dirt. And they do have a very earthy flavor. It's just important that you do clean them off really well. We're going to rinse them under cold water. We're going to trim off the tops. Now, the tops are just as good as the roots, so don't throw those away. A lot of people tend to just discard the tops of the beets, but they're great sautéed. You can make any kind of a stewed greens dish with the beet greens. All right, so now we're going to trim up the beets. We're going to roast them in the oven until they're very tender. And once they are tender, you can puncture them with a knife. Then they'll be ready to make the vinaigrette. I've got my beets ready right here. Again, very tender. When I stick the knife into it, it releases. It feels very, very soft. We're just going to cut off the top and the bottom and peel them. All right. Then I'm going to add some orange juice, a little bit of orange zest as well, a little bit of honey. Okay, we're going to add some olive oil, a little pinch of my sweet seasoned spice blend, which you could also use a little cinnamon, a little nutmeg in there, 2 cloves of garlic, and just a little bit of water, about 1/4 cup of water. And for our acid, we're going to use a little vinegar. If you wanted it spicy, you could add a little bit of chili pepper. Okay, going to just put the blender on.
If you go onto the website, look for the bright pink sauce that adorns many of our dishes. That's this beet vinaigrette. And it's as delicious as it is pretty. EarthEats.org. Coming up...
I think it's whatever you're raised on. And still, if you go to places like Nashville, Indiana, and you go to the IGA grocery store, they have frog legs because people eat frog legs there.
Yep, frog legs. Don't knock them till you've tried them. Chef Daniel Orr has a recipe coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 4 locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com.
Leaping lizards. I usually just do these on leap year. Ba-dum-bump. Serve them with Frog's Leap Vineyard wine. Ba-dum-bump. All right, here we go.
You'll be here all day. When you were a kid eating these, this frog's legs didn't gross you out?
Oh, I love frog legs. I mean, I think it's whatever you're raised on. And still, if you go to places like Nashville, Indiana, and you go to the IGA grocery store, they have frog legs because people eat frog legs there. All right, so we got our frog legs. I like the smaller ones. You know, when I was a kid, we used to get those jumbo frog legs. But I like to use ones that, you know, they're about 2.5 to 3 inches long. Then I marinate them with a little buttermilk. In the marinade, I've got some garlic, some crushed red pepper, and a little lemon zest. And then we mix that all together. A little bit of salt and pepper. Okay, now it's best to let these sit in the mixture for about an hour. And that allows the buttermilk and the flavorings to... sink in, and then we're going to add 1 egg, and that's going to help adhere the crust to the frog legs. Okay, we're going to really toss the frog legs in with the buttermilk and egg mixture, put them in the flour mixture, and then toss those again, and we want to give them a nice coating of the breadcrumbs. Now let's go over to the stove. All right, so we've got those well-coated frog legs. We're going to drop them into some nice hot oil. I've got about a quarter inch of oil. You can hear those sizzling in the pan. We're going to turn down the heat a little bit. We're going to cook them about a minute and a half on each side until they get really, really crunchy. Since they are small, they don't take a long time to cook.
Looking good.
After that first side is cooked, we're going to flip them over. And you can see they're nice and crunchy, kind of like fried chicken.
They really do taste like chicken. That's not just a saying.
Well, you're gonna know.
This is going to be my first frog leg of my life.
Really?
Ever.
Have you had snails yet?
I have had escargot, yeah. So,
you know, some French delicacies.
Wait a minute. If I said no, I hadn't tried snails, would we have done that next show on Earth Eats?
Yes, I think we may have to do some snails next.
I've also never had filet mignon.
Okay. And caviar and foie gras, right?
Exactly.
All right. Once these get nice and crispy, and what we want to do is we're looking at the pan, and we want the oil that's in the pan to go clear again. That will mean that all the moisture has been cooked out of the flour and the frog legs, and that will mean that they're crispy and they're done. So you can see that kind of that white foamy look is going away, and we're getting more clear oil. That's allowing us to know that our frog legs are getting close. Okay, so we discard all that oil, but we still have that nice hot pan. It still's got some nice flavors in there from the seasonings. Throw in our butter. Okay, and you can see it's nice and foamy. We're going to go ahead and add the garlic, a quarter cup of butter, and a good 2 tablespoons of garlic, half tablespoon of lemon zest, and a half cup of parsley. We add our frog legs back, and then we add a little salt and pepper. Toss the frog legs back on the platter, and those are our grenouille à la Provençale, or French style frog legs with garlic and parsley.
This recipe at eartheats.org. Sometimes it can be tough to get creative, out-of-the-box thinking chefs to settle on exact proportions for their recipes. Lots of emails going back and forth to make sure we've got it just right before it goes online. Vicki Bassman had a similar experience in Pearl Lagoon. So talk about trying to create recipes out of these dishes that are really just created by feel.
Right. I never saw a single recipe book being used, and I never saw a single measuring instrument being used, especially when they were the women making large quantities of baked goods because they took them to the cooperatively owned bakeries and sold them. They would make hundreds of journey cakes at a time. They would make hundreds of toto. They would make hundreds of coconut bread. And so to them, it was amusing that somebody would want to come and watch them and try and write it down. I guessed at quantities. I was lucky that I was able to take my then 17-year-old daughter, Emma, with me. And so I had somebody to kind of confer with, you know, did that look like a tablespoon? Did that look like a teaspoon?
Oh, my gosh.
I couldn't even ask the women or the men making the recipe because they don't use tablespoons or teaspoons, so it meant nothing to them. If I were to even ask them, was that about a teaspoon? They'd say,
what's that?
Yeah, Miss Vicki, it was just a pinch. You know, I would get that comment all the time. So coming home and reproducing the recipes, we did the best we could. But one of my strongest sentences in the book is adjust to your own taste. That's what they did. That's what I had to do. And that's what I hope people who try these recipes will do.
We're going to talk about Johnny Cakes in just a moment, but the beet drink. So I flipped through there. I saw beets, simple as can be. Beets, sugar, lime juice, and orange juice to taste. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
So simplicity is the name of the game?
Simplicity is always the name of the game. And that was an interesting day because the woman who was cooking that day, Miss Arlene, she had welcomed us into her home. She had planned a meal. But I could tell as it was being put together, two things happened. One, she had a daughter who was in an adjacent bedroom who was about 8 months pregnant, mm-hmm. and not feeling well. And so Miss Arlene was creating a meal more to take care of her daughter than to take care of tourists, which was really a wonderful opportunity to see. And that beet drink was something she just threw together because she felt like, this is what my daughter needs. She needs the vitamins that are in beets. And I don't think it was planned in advance. She just grabbed those beets. Of course, they always have lime, lemon, and orange juice available. And she grated it. And yeah, I had never had a, you know, beets prepared in both a drink and a salad so easily and so quickly. Mm-hmm. It was delicious.
Yeah, it looks really good. Okay, so Johnny Cakes. We got to get to this. Johnny Cakes make a couple appearances in the cookbook. Basic ingredients, not the healthiest ingredients, but we got some sort of fat, salt, sugar, flour, and then one recipe uses coconut milk. The other one uses the trash from coconut.
Yeah.
What?
So coconut, which is in almost all the foods, the men or the women take the coconut. They chop off the ends with a machete, holding the coconut in their hand. And I am if it were me, I would have no digits left on my hand.
Do not try this at home, folks.
I know. So they cut off the ends and they take off the brown outer husk. Then they put a large grater. It's about 2 foot long. They put it over a tub and real quickly they grate the coconut with the what's left of the brown husk and then the white meat. And, of course, all of the milk comes out at the same time. So they just grate that very fast. And a few times they let me grate it. And each time they would let me grate it, no matter which cook it was, they would say, Miss Vicky, be careful of your knuckles. So you could tell they'd learned as children when grating coconuts, you know, you get your knuckle in there and you grate your knuckles. So in the bowl then is all of that mash. And then they add some water and they squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. Then they pour it through a strainer. So what you end up with, that's your coconut milk. So it does have water added to it, but it's a little lighter in consistency than our canned coconut milk. Then if they want to take some handfuls of the grated mash that's left behind and throw that in, they call that the trash. And I loved the Journey Cakes or the Toto when they would put the trash in because it gives you – it's different than the flaked coconut that we buy at the store because sometimes you'd have bits of that brown husk in there too. So it was kind of gritty and chewy and it just gave a really good texture, in my opinion. I always asked them to keep the trash in.
Vicky Bassman is the author of Pearls from the Lagoon, Short Stories and Recipes. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can try making Johnny Cakes for yourself. The recipe is on our website, eartheats.org. Vicky Bassman is the Chief of Interpretation for Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs. She'll be back next week with tips for being a sustainable food tourist. Hope you come back for that. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Vicky Bassman, Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, Therapeutic Massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years. Building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. This is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.